Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Say knuckleheads to a music lover in Kansas City, and they know that's the old saloon down by the railroad tracks. The saloon, an old boarding house, was built in 1887 when the music of the day sang of the Old West, cowboys, and trains. These days, it's the place where performers as diverse as Nick Lowe, Merle Haggard, and Kerry Rodriguez play when they hit town. And sometimes their performances are sung to the sound of the trains rolling by. Later on this hour, the Poet Laureate of Kansas and Victor Wishna is back with his latest installment of A Fan's Notes. But first up, Knuckleheads. With us is Knuckleheads owner Frank Hicks. And Frank, so good to have you. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for asking me.
The old place was built in 1887, and what, back in those days, it was an old boarding house?
It was a boarding house for trains, and the way I understand its story is that Heinz Brewery, which is behind me, built that and built a track so people could come down from, like, City Market and, you know, taste a brewery and all that. And they had a place called Electric Park across the street.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a real big thing in Kansas City in the early 1900s. And so the Heinz Brewery would flow beer over there through a pipeline, and they'd have the beer at the park, and then they built – they had to have –
Those were the days.
Yeah, so they had this boarding house for the trains that people worked, you know, ride a train. I think it was like 25 or 50 cents to ride a train all day long, and many times you wanted something like that.
Mm-hmm. At what point in the history of Knuckleheads did it become a music venue?
Well, after a while – I don't know the whole story on this, but a doctor bought the building years ago. And the lady that lived in there when I first moved down the area, I got business across the street. And I had a body shop for trucks, so I was looking for an obscure place to put it that people wouldn't be, you know, raising cane about me, the smell and the trucks running and all that. So I found this abandoned fire station, not abandoned, but they consolidated a fire station and moved them up on Independence Avenue. So I found this fire station, and I built onto it and made my collision repair shop. And right across the street, this lady lived there, and she was about 70 at the time. And I moved in 80 or 81, and she was about 70, and then, you know, she was the one that was always raising cane. Oh, I don't want to hear them trucks and all that. So I finally became friends with her. I heard, you know, I shoveled her snow and then moved stuff for her and all this. So we became really good, pretty good friends. And what it was, the doctors that bought this thing, they kind of turned it into a duplex. One side was a chiropractor, and the other side was an MD. Well, the MD gave, the way I understand the story, I'm not sure it's 100%, but the way I understand the story, the lady was born there, and the MD delivered her. Now, I don't know what happened to her mother and father, but he raised her.
Hmm.
And when he passed away, he left everything he had to her, which I don't know was, if it was that much or not, but he left the house and, you know, his belongings and his savings account and so forth. So she would always call, like a repairman, come to repair the roof or paint the house. And her being, you know, 70 years old, they would just gouge her. They would, you know, instead of taking the roof off, put a new one on, they'd throw one on top of it, or they'd paint without scraping. And, so she started relying on me to, hey, will you look this over and tell me what it did? So anyway, I think it was 85.
Mm-hmm.
She called me over one day, said, I'm going to go to a nursing home because I'm 76 years old now. And, you know, she gave me some little gifts that she'd been, you know, it was kind of an emotional time. And
yeah.
Asked me whatever I wanted in the house I could have. I said, you know, and she really lived downstairs where the gift shop's at now.
Mm-hmm.
That was her main living room. And so, you know, I took two little glasses. One had, for some reason, I had my first name or my first initial and my wife's first initial. She gave those to me. And anyway, the house sat empty for a while. And
where Knuckleheads is now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we had, I called it, one of my wife's relatives, Louis DeLuna, had DeLuna Realty, and wanted to buy the place. Well, they made a ridiculous price for it, and we said no. And this guy was really good at what he did, and so he just kept negotiating the price, and we kept telling him, who wants a place down here, you know,
mm-hmm.
across from a truck company, and, you know, what are you going to do with it?
Right.
So I think it became really more of a liability and asset for him. They, you know, they've always been kind of like, you know, wanting to get rid of it, so I can't even tell you what I paid. I mean, I stole it. I really stole it.
That's the way to do it.
So at 85, I thought, what am I going to do with this place now? But, you know, I didn't really want another neighbor there that I had to get to know and all that. So I used it for storage for a while, and it was still livable, so I put one of my employees over there, and he watched the place and so forth. Well, then if you got time, this story, but
we're there.
Okay,
we're rolling.
Well, and I started really getting into motorcycles. I started riding Harleys all the time, and so with me owning a body shop, the perfect thing to do was buy a motorcycle, fix it up, preferably a wrecked one or something, you know, from an insurance company, fix it up and customize it the way I wanted it. Well, I started doing that, and then when I would ride them to different places, people say, "What do you want for it?" And I would just, you know, I've always been kind of a car salesman anyway. What do you want for it? And I just, if I had $15,000, I'd throw out $18,000,
mm-hmm.
and they'd buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, okay, now I got to go build me another one. So I started this, and at one time, my wife pulled into the garage. And goes, "You got 8 Harleys sitting here. What are you doing?" "I can't even put the car in." I said, "Well, I'm building motorcycles." So this was a hobby. I was doing it after work, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if I needed painting, I'd take them down to the shop and so forth. Well, it became to the point where I really needed to get parts wholesale because I was spending so much money. And so I talked to the people, and you had to have a storefront. Well, I had a storefront. It was knucklehead, you know. And so I made this storefront, and I had to buy, I believe it was $100,000 worth of parts a year. And I was buying about 40 myself. You know? So I said, okay, so I put the stock in there, and not a lot, just, you know, just a, basically it was a fake storefront, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I started telling some of my friends, you know, like, "Hey, Steve, come down, I'll sell you a part for your motorcycle. I don't want you to tell nobody else, but I'll sell it to you." So what I was doing is just getting that $100,000.
Built back.
Built back.
Yeah.
And so the thing that happened was the people that were coming down there started telling their friends. Next thing you know, they're pulling me out of my real job over there all day to sell parts. I'm like, I don't want, this is a business I didn't really want, you know? But so I hired a counterman, and we became a full-fledged business. And it did pretty well for us, and we started doing street parties because we were in a place that was obscure and nobody knew how to get there and trying to explain
I've
to them.
I've noticed as I've come down there before finding it, if it wasn't for my neighbor Phil Fields, I never would get there. Yeah.
Well, and trying to get people there was like, it was a real trick. And so what we'd do, we'd have street parties, and we'd block the street off, call the city, and then get permits to block the street off. And because at that time, because I owned all four corners, so it's fairly easy to get the city to do that. And we'd have street parties out there, and all these guys would come down. We'd have put a flatbed trailer out. My first band was Trampling the Foot, but it wasn't Trampling the Foot. It was called Fresh Brew at the time. But Danielle was 17 years old, so
right.
played out in front of the flatbed.
We got to get them in here sometime, by the way.
Yeah. And so it started growing, and these street parties become like, you know, we started doing like 4 to 6 a year, and there'd be 1,000 people come down. And so basically what we were doing,
the bells start going off in your head. There's maybe,
well, we had, I furnished beer, a free beer for a long time. Mm-hmm. For 1,000 people, that's a lot of money. So I said one day, I said, I can't keep doing this. So I went up and got my liquor license, which was kind of hard to do because if you tell the liquor department you're a motorcycle shop and you want a beer license, they go, you know, first thing they think is the Hell's Angels and, you know, and they're chicken bones all over the floor, you know.
Yeah.
It was really hard to get, but I finally got it. They come down and looked at the place and, you know. You've been there before, but you know where the kitchen's at.
Yeah.
That was originally a knucklehead. That's all it was. The rest of it was a motorcycle shop. And so we started – a friend of mine was a musician here in Kansas City for 35 years. He started coming down on Saturday, and we was only only open as knuckleheads from Saturday from noon to 6.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only hours.
Mm-hmm.
We closed up. And he'd come down with his guitar, and the next thing you know, it was like a little jam session going on, and – this guy got bigger and bigger, so the Harley started moving a little farther away. Knucklehead's gotten bigger.
So, well, at what point did you decide to take the plunge and really turn it into a music venue almost 7 days a week?
Well, it was really kind of weird. I was doing the Saturday turned into Saturday night, then it turned into, well, if you're going to be here Saturday night, you must be here Friday night. Then if you're going to be here Friday night, you must be here Wednesday night. Then I go, why did we close Wednesday? I mean, I'm here Wednesday, close Thursday, and Friday, Saturday.
Why do that? Yeah.
So then we become four nights a week. And so we started having, you know, a lot of bands in there and started doing live music. Well, in 2004, the Grand Emporium was sold out. Roger and Herb sold the Grand Emporium. And I started having people call me. And it was really ironic because the first person to call me was Leon Russell's agent.
Really?
It was. And I was really a Leon Russell fan. Actually, it was the first concert I ever seen. I think it was 69.
Wow.
At the Memorial... No, it was in this auditorium.
You always remember your first concert, don't
Mad
you?
Dogs and Englishmen
mm-hmm.
with Jim Cochran. And so it was like I was really, you know, real gung-ho about this. Hey, I want to book Leon Russell. So we agreed to a price, and it was like a lot more money I've ever paid before. But, you know, you got to remember I'm buying and selling motorcycles, and so I thought, well, what's the difference between buying and selling talent? You know, you buy it and you sell it to the public. So, you know, so I thought, well, I'm going to try it, you know, and so I did.
What was the price tag? Do you recall?
Yeah.
Back in those days?
Should I say?
Well, yeah.
It's long. It was $4,000.
Yeah. It seemed like that was real money back in those
it
days.
It was real money, yeah. Especially if you only used to pay $200 or $300 a band, you know?
Yeah.
And so what happened was I'm just kind of an old school guy that when I say I want to do something, if you tell me to be here today at 11, I'm here at 11. And so I made an agreement with his agent, and they said, okay, and it's $4,000. I said, okay. So it was to me, it was booked, and I was average, you know, telling everybody, hey, we've got Leon Russell coming down July 10th and so forth. And I picked up a pitch and said, Leon Russell at the Madrid Theater, July 10th.
Oh.
I thought, now, how's this going to happen?
Yeah.
So I called the guy up, and he goes, well, they give $4,500. Well, I said, well, I didn't know it was a bidding war because, you know, when you tell me it was done, it was done. Well, but, yeah, they offered $500 more. You know, I said, so.
First lesson learned that
my
in
first
the music
lesson,
business,
yes.
Right?
That was
this is how this world works.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So what'd you do?
Well, I didn't hire Leon Russell. He played in Madrid. But I told the guy I would never hire nobody from him again. I haven't. Mm-hmm. Really, I've really kept that promise. I mean, he's got some people I wouldn't mind having, but I just won't book to him. So what we did, in November 2004, we had Intrepid Artists called and had two blues acts. Actually, it was three blues acts. It was Little Ed and Blues Imperials, and it was Anthony Gomes and Kenny Neal.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tried it all in 1 week. I thought, man, this is, you know, but why not, you know? So we did one Thursday, one Friday, and one Saturday.
And?
It went over real well. Kenny Neal was a little, you know, short, but it was Thursday night. But Little Ed did real well, and Anthony Gomes did real well. So that was the beginning. So then we started.
So have you added on to the building over the years?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's what I see now. You have the extra auxiliary room, music room, that's mm-hmm. now there. So it's a bigger place than it was when you first got involved.
Yeah, when I first got that, I didn't tell you this, but all the property were the courtyard, what I call the courtyard, out by the outside stage and the bar, seating for the inside stage was all gravel. It was a bunch of buildings, and I bought them and tore them down. And leveled it and became, you know, so as we needed it, we just built and built and built. And then the stage used to be in the caboose, and we had they call it tornado, not really a tornado, it was like a microburst come through there, tore the roof off of the building that the stage is in now.
Mm.
And I was always wondering, you know, after you do something, you always get hindsight to go, why didn't I do it this way? And I had the stage actually pointing north at my neighbors, you know, so if they go. Raise any heck, it was going to be because, you know, I was making too much noise. Well, when the roof came off, it came down, smashed all the picnic table, and smashed everything. And so the insurance company came in and paid me for that. I thought, well, now if I'm going to redo all this, I might as well do it the way I want it. So I put the stage blowing to the east, which is there's no neighbors. It's just trains and stuff.
Well, speaking of trains, trains roll trains. By all the time. And I'm wondering, how do your performers react to that when the trains come in the middle of a set, which happens all the time down there?
It does, you know, and there's very few, but there's a few it really irritates. Most of the time, like the first time I remember Leon playing, he was facing north, so the train was behind him, and he was right there at the caboose, so the train was maybe, what, 20 feet, you know?
It was right there.
And went by, and it honked its horn, and it scared him to death, you know? It just literally scared him to death.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they have, you know, like, there's so many people that they break into a train song.
Merle Haggard.
Yeah, Merle Haggard, he was playing, and the train went by, and he just smiled real big and said, oh, yeah. And just, I forget what song he was playing, but he just stopped that song. Went right into Folsom Prison Blues.
Yeah. Didn't Joe Ely do something similar?
Joe Ely's got a song called Boxcar, and it's got this, he plays it with an accordion, and he makes the accordion sound like a train. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so at that particular time, he was playing outside. The train came by, and you really, honest to God, couldn't have paid the guy to blow the whistle. No, exact time, you know? And he come by, and Joe got this big old grin on his face. Oh, I've been waiting 20 years for that. You
know? He hit it just perfectly. Yeah.
And Reverend Peyton was down there one time, and he just stopped. He was so fascinated by the train that he stopped, and everybody was taking videos. He said, take a video of the train. They got this number, whatever it was, 15 40 or something on train. If you look on YouTube, it's there, and he's up there clapping, having a good time. And, you know.
Well, do you tell your performers when you book them that, hey, by the way, a train just might roll by at some point 25 feet away from where you'll be performing?
Sometimes I do, and most of the time I don't. I really don't think about it too much, but like I did do that.
You're used to it, but they're not.
Right.
You know?
I did do that with Merle Haggard because now Ray Price, he's not fond of the trains. He can live with them, but he's not fond of them. But he's got the same age as Merle Haggard, so I've been trying to get Merle Haggard for 2 years. And so anyway, the agent called Ray, said, well, what's it like playing up there? He says, pretty good, but them damn trains.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. We're visiting with Knuckleheads owner Frank Hicks. Knuckleheads, an old boarding house that's down in the East Bottoms, and it's become sort of a great place for roots music and honky-tonk and everything else in Kansas City. If you want to recall maybe a great show you saw down there at Knuckleheads, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. What are some of the great shows that you recall from over the years, Frank? The ones that there's so many, but what stands out for you?
Well, I mean, I really like Ray Price.
Because?
Ray, I just, you know, he was like the country gentleman. He was kind of like the Frank Sinatra of country music almost.
He's always, a real thing.
He really is. And the nudie suits and stuff. And I remember the first time he came in. He came in, and, you know, when they ride around the bus, of course, they go wear their relaxed clothes and stuff. He came in with these Sansa belts. You know, Sansa belts are where you wear them clear up to.
up real high.
Yeah, real high, and he had his suspenders on. I go, oh, no, that can't be Ray Price. You know, and that's not the Ray Price I had pictured, you know. But he came in, and he was such a nice guy. He came in, it was incredible. He walks around, and we got pictures all over the wall, and he walks by, and he starts looking at all these pictures and stuff, and goes, son, you've had some really great artists here. And I'm thinking, no, I have now, you know. And so I'd tell you this story, too. It's bad on my part, but it's kind of funny. I asked him what he wanted. Now, all these rock stars always have these
contracts.
Contracts. They want everything.
You know? M&Ms, but no brown ones.
Cereals and all. Give me some cereals. And
do they do that for you at Knuckleheads?
Do you
You have to meet those kinds of conditions?
A lot of them you do, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was picturing that with
major league stadium venues as opposed to smaller places like Knuckleheads.
Well, we try to tell them, we got an in-house kitchen and stuff. And sometimes it works, sometimes it don't. Mm-hmm. But they want like a bowl of Cheerios. What are you going to do with a bowl of Cheerios at 9 o'clock at night? You
know?
Anyway, so I asked Ray, I said, what do you want? He says, can you give me a six-pack of Diet Coke? And I thought, man, this is going to be easy, right? So we don't really carry canned pop, so I sent one of my guys down to Quick Trip to get the Diet Coke. So, I'm real weird about the artist. I try to leave them alone because I don't want to be like
intrusive.
A fan. You know. Sometimes maybe I leave them alone too much. Maybe they think I'm, arrogant or something, but I'm not. I just want them to have their space and, relax and stuff. So I didn't bother Ray. This was like probably 9 o'clock in the morning. So by noon, I knock on the door. You need anything? I thought maybe he wants some lunch or something. No, but I sure like to have that Diet Coke. I'm going, you haven't got the Diet Coke yet. You know, so I'm ready. I'm beside myself. It's a simple thing. Just go get a six-pack of Coke.
Yeah.
So I went, and it was a pretty hot day. It was like August, I think. And so I went and asked the guy that was supposed to get it. I said, where's the Diet Coke? Well, you didn't tell me what to do with it. It's still in the car. So now I got a six-pack of hot Diet Coke.
And Ray just had to make do then. Yeah. Anybody give you a hard time in terms of, hey, I'm not playing unless you give me the M&Ms without the brown ones? Or
No, not really. I mean, they're pretty – I've had a couple of them that – what they do is, see, they hire the tour manager. And the tour manager is always the one that's kind of like the drill sergeant. Mm-hmm. You got to deal with him to get to whoever. Well, Ray has a tour manager that's really easy to get along with. But some of them, like Billy Bob Thornton, his tour manager, he really was a drill sergeant. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's got to be this way, you know.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was pretty hard to get along with.
Well, we've already mentioned Leon Russell. He's one of your favorite artists. You've mentioned that. Tell us about the night he played Knuckleheads and what that was like for you to have the great Leon Russell right in your place.
The first night?
Yeah.
Well, it really was great because, like I say, here was a guy that I admired all my life. And Leon's very shy. Hmm. People don't know that he really is shy, but they take it he doesn't talk much.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so anyway, he was pretty shy, so we didn't really talk a lot. I was just sitting there kind of in awe. There's Leon Russell here, so they're like really in my eyes, it was really cool to have him here. And he was there like a couple times, and then there's a fellow by the name of T. Graham Brown came in. And we were talking about Leon, but he saw the picture or something, and I told him, I said, man, I said, this guy's the hardest guy to talk to I've ever seen.
Huh.
And he goes, well, he's really just shy. And they ask him, he said, next time he comes in, ask him, hey, old man, you still gigging? And I thought, man, I don't want to say that to you. So the next time, you know, I always get to, I get to the job, I'll go get him at the bus and walk him to the door, you know.
He came in the bus?
Yes. He always comes in the bus.
A tour bus that comes to the door. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. So he parks at the parking lot, and then I walk him from the parking lot to the front door because he stays on his bus all the time. He mm-hmm. uses that for a green room.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just thought, well, what have I got to lose? I wouldn't talk to him anyway, you know.
Yeah.
Been there like three times. And I said, hey, I got a question for you. Hey, old man, are you still gigging? And he goes, when was T. Graham Brown here?
He knew exactly what was going on. Let's play just a little clip from Leon Russell. This is him singing Roll Away the Stone from his self-titled 1970 album. Leon Russell.
Well, it's such a strange world that I'm living in. She was my woman and it was my friend, but I was wrong again. Such a strange change that you put me through. But like a fool, I'm still in love with you. What can this poor boy do?
For a shy guy, Frank, he sure can sing, can he?
He's
coming back. You told me before the show, he's coming back.
Yeah, he's coming back June 23rd.
That's a reason to live, to go see Leon Russell. Who else has stood out to you over the years? You mentioned Billy Bob Thornton. Tell us about him.
Well, Billy Bob Thornton, I mean, he's the guy I've been watching in movies and stuff, and I didn't know how he was going to be, you know, because he portrays this real tough guy on the,
yeah,
you know. And so he came in, and all this big entourage come in with him, and of course the drill sergeant, you got to take this door out, you got to take this window out, and Billy can't come through this door. We're going to take all the stage stuff and we'll make big, what do you call it, like a television set where mm-hmm. they got trains running behind him and mm-hmm. stuff. Yeah, but Billy was really cool. He just didn't want to be asked about Angelina Jolie.
No.
It's the only thing. Don't ask me
don't
about that.
Don't go there. Yeah, I get that.
So we started talking. We sat out in the courtyard forever and just had a good time. And his guy and my guy started arm wrestling, and we started betting on who was going to win. It was pretty cool. It really was.
We had Lyle Lovett once, and it became very clear very quickly, don't go to the Julia Roberts question. Just don't go there. They're tired of answering it. Yeah. Let's listen to a little bit of Billy Bob Thornton. This is from his 2008 album, Christmas Cheer. This is Billy Bob Thornton and the Boxmasters performing I Won't Be Home for Christmas.
Outside the window, in my memory, snow is coming down. I can smell the cedar and the cider all over town. Then reality comes back and shakes me from my bed. The sound of rattling cages takes me out of my head. I won't be home for Christmas this year. Just like the one before and the one before I'm here. In this cold steel and concrete, I'm spending Christmas Day with plenty.
That's Billy Bob Thornton. So what kind of music are you aiming for down there? What's sort of the classification you're shooting for?
All of it.
All of it? Really?
Yeah, I really don't want to be stuck in any genre. I mean, mm-hmm. we started out as being a blues club, and we're mm-hmm. still known as being a blues club, and I love blues. But I also like country, and I like the red dirt, and I like the Americana, and I like the folk music, and, you know. We don't do a lot of jazz. I like jazz. I like mm-hmm. certain, I mean,
some of it.
Some of it, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I don't do hip-hop, and I don't do real hard heavy metal. Of course, we did have, like, Skid Row down there. But it's just basically good music. You know, just it don't matter what genre it is.
Well, Frank, you knew this question was coming. Someone's called in to ask how to get there, as it seems to be a little confusing. I guess you can go to the Knuckleheads KC website and get directions. There's a map right there, which might help, and maybe a compass and everything else, right?
Well, what I usually tell everybody, there's several ways to go, but the easiest way, if they get down to the city market on 3rd and Grand and come east on 3rd Street and just stay with it no matter what it changes into, just stay east on 3rd Street. And come to Montgall, you turn, take a left, it's one block, you cross railroad tracks, it's right there.
Okay, that's one easy way to do it. Lots of phone calls here for Frank Hicks, the owner of Knuckleheads. We're talking about great shows at that great concert venue. Let's go to some calls here and go to Joey from Kansas City, Missouri. Joey, good morning.
Morning.
What was your favorite show at Knuckleheads, Joey?
Well, I appreciate it. You know, one of my favorite shows that I've been to in Kansas City was the last Wilder show at Knuckleheads, and that was just last year. My question is, you know, anything memorable about the show, obviously, but also what does it mean to have a great local band, such a part of the community, have something like its farewell show at Knuckleheads? It was just one of the best atmospheres I've been to in a long time.
Yeah, great question, Joey. Thanks.
Well, Joey, I think that the thing is that I was really honored that they wanted to have it there. The Wilders are a great group. They called me, and I just think it was an honor that that they wanted to have it there, and I was just really tickled to death that they wanted to have it there. And they've been there several times, and I just really love the guys, and I mean Nate and Betsy and all of them. But it was just a magical night, and I mean everybody felt it, and it was just good, and it just they enjoyed it, and the fans enjoyed it, and the staff enjoyed it. So I mean, how could it go wrong?
You know, some nights I imagine it just things click. You can tell when first 15, 20 minutes that this is going to be a special night. Can you feel it as the owner of the place?
Oh yes, definitely.
Yeah, you just can tell. Let's go to Joe from Kansas City, Missouri. Joe, you're on with Frank Hicks. Good morning.
Yeah, hey, good morning, Frank. Love what you guys do. Knuckleheads is an essential part of Kansas City culture. When I have folks come out of town, I take them straight to Knuckleheads. My favorite shows, it's a competition because I caught the Grizzly Hand there several times, and the Sawyers. And those are just great local talent. To tap into the previous question.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry. No, go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry.
You do an over-the-top Elvis tribute every year that I have to see, and I just love the talent that you bring in. But also, every Friday you have an impersonator. I think it's Jeff Bergen, or you used to. You got an affiliation or affinity or a passion for the King?
Well, it's the last Friday of every month he plays, but yes, I do. I mean, if you go back into the retro lounge, I call it, there's pictures all over. I've always been a big fan of Elvis.
Yeah.
That's a great spot. Thanks so much for what you do, Frank.
Yeah, Joe, thank you. Christine from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Christine.
Well, I just wanted to say that Frank is a Class A gentleman, and I've seen many, 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 many good shows up there, and I think one of my favorite is Buddy Guy. I could not believe I was that close to Buddy Guy ever in my life.
Tell us about Buddy Guy, Frank.
Well, Buddy come in here, and like I say, Buddy's got his own club and everything, but he is a legend. He's a blues legend. He was a perfect gentleman.
Was he?
And, you know, I've seen him at different places like the Voodoo Lounge and the Uptown Theater and stuff, but he just had fun there. He just really had fun and grinned. He was supposed to play 75 minutes. He played almost 2 hours.
No kidding.
He just kept playing, and he told me, he says, now, I want to come back. He said, my mom always told me, don't wear your welcome out, so I don't want to come back next year. Make it a year after.
When you sign the contract with him, and Christine, thanks for the call, when you sign the contract, does it specify they're going to play for so many minutes?
Yes.
And is it usually 75 or
usually the bigger their artist, the shorter the time. Sometimes it's 60 minutes, but usually it's 75, and sometimes they'll say 75 to 90.
Okay, and do you go below 75 occasionally?
We've signed a contract where they could do it like 60 minutes, but not very often.
And when they sign it, do they typically go 60 minutes and they're off, or do they stick around a little longer?
No, they stick. All the ones I've had at my place stick around. Now, I think what they do, I think it's kind of the precaution, like the M&Ms, like you said a while ago. I think it's a precaution if they don't like the place, get out of there in 60 minutes.
Yeah.
The M&Ms, the only reason they do that is to be able to get out of the, break the contract. They don't care about the M&Ms.
Yeah.
It's just the way if they get there, they horribly hate the place, so they can break the contract.
Do you have people who pull up and say, nah, this place doesn't work for me? Does it ever happen?
No, but I did have one guy, one band was really funny because they come down, and you've been there, so you come through this old industrial area, and the few houses there are pretty old and stuff. But they come down and go, who booked this gig? And then all of a sudden turn the corner, oh, hey, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. But yeah, that happens a few times.
It has happened.
I can imagine. Let's go to Fred from Kansas City, Missouri. Fred, you're on Up to Date. If you want to call in with your favorite show you've seen at Knuckleheads, 816-235-2888. Fred, go ahead.
Yeah, last time I was there, we saw Kinky Friedman. And I wondered if there was any good stories you can tell us about him, and is he coming back?
Well, he is coming back. I don't know when, but I could tell you all kind of stories, but I'm thinking I'll see him on the air.
Well, be careful.
I know. They'd be putting his red buttons.
I was just trying to dare you.
Yeah.
They'd be putting these red buttons on me if I tell them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got it.
Fred, thanks for the phone call. I appreciate it. Tim from Leavenworth writes, we heard Greg Brown at Knuckleheads a few years ago. Despite the trains, I think it's a really neat venue. Keep up the good work. Jane from Kansas City, Missouri writes, my favorite show was Tommy Castro's Winter Show a few years ago, only wish the venue was larger so everyone who wants to see his band can get inside. How often is that a problem?
Well, it's a problem a lot of times. I mean, we have a lot of sold-out shows. People come down and they get upset because they can't come in, but again, you would lose the personality of the thing if you made it too big, because that's just like what they said a while ago, like Christine said, where are you going to see Buddy Guy up that close and personal? So
yeah,
that makes it special. So I think that part of it outweighs the other part. But yes, there's several times I'd like to have a bigger venue to put more people in there, but you know, it is what it is, I guess. You know?
Well, Frank, we're out of time, but boy, thanks for calling in. So good to have you here this morning, and good luck with all the work out at Knuckleheads. Okay, I'll be out sometime soon.
Thanks for asking.
You bet. That's Frank Hicks. He's the owner of Knuckleheads. More information about Knuckleheads, knuckleheadskc.com. Okay, that sounds good. Coming up, the Poet Laureate of Kansas. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.